This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. If you don't have to think about where your next meal comes from, you're one of the lucky ones. We know that many low-income Hoosiers struggle to find fresh, healthy food. For many of them, their food comes from the convenience store, dollar store, or the dollar menu. In Indianapolis alone, it's estimated that around 200,000 residents live in food deserts. This hour, we'll learn more about this complicated problem and ways it's being addressed. Have you struggled with food insecurity? How did you get by? Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. Joining me now is Jonathan Lawler, owner of Brandywine Creek Farms. Jonathan, thanks for coming.
Thank you.
And we're also joined by Robert Hurst, owner of A&I Variety Meats and Produce on the Far East Side. Hi, Robert.
Hey, how you doing?
Robert, can you talk about what A&I is and what can I buy there?
A&I is a community store, grocery store, and what you can buy there, fresh produce, fresh vegetables, fruit, fresh meat. We try to have everything fresh.
You're not talking about shelves of, say, pasta mix or things like that that you'd find at, like, Family Dollar. You're talking about real fresh, whole food.
Real food. Real.
Now, this is the first time you've opened a grocery store, right?
Yes, sir.
And why did you and your wife decide to do that?
Well, what led us to do this, I used to be in construction, and I got tired of doing that, and I was just sitting around asking her, and we were just talking about what I can do next. And we ended up going to Mississippi to visit her family. They had two grocery stores down there, and that's when the idea came to me to open up a grocery store. And when I got back here to Indianapolis, you know, I started doing my research and stuff, and I never knew what a food desert was until I started doing my due diligence, finding, you know, looking on USDA website, and upon looking at that, seeing the national average for a food desert is like 15.5%. Indianapolis was at 19.9, very high. So,
this is like percentage of like neighborhoods served or not served by a grocery store.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Yeah. And, you know, the city of Indianapolis has the highest food desert rate. And just and what brought us over to the east side, our daughter goes to a daycare over there, and we're just riding around looking, and I was like, I said, there's no grocery stores over here. And what's over here is stuff like restaurants like McDonald's, Taco Bell, Family Dollar, stores that sell a lot of processed foods and stuff. Mm-hmm. And seeing, you know, the kids walking around is really big and stuff. And, you know, so that's what led us to do it.
So, yeah, what's it like right now to find healthy food on the Far East Side? It seems like it's a bit of a challenge until you came along.
Yeah, I was just going to say, yeah, until A&I came along. But, you know, it's still a struggle with that also because some of them are so used to still going over to the Family Dollars and stuff. But now I'm starting to see an increase in sales and stuff because more people are noticing that A&I is there.
You were talking about, what was it, Mississippi?
Yes, sir.
Was this a similar type neighborhood, but they had two grocery stores that had fresh produce and fresh meats and things like that?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. So very different from your situation.
Mm-hmm.
How has business gone since you opened up? You opened in January.
Yes, sir.
What have you learned about the business of running a small store like this?
Patience. Patience. You got to have patience.
Well, in what way? What do you mean by that?
I mean, because, you know, just because I have you open up a store or whatever, you can't expect everybody to start rushing in.
Patience for the clientele.
Patience for the people coming in. Yes, sir.
In.
And another thing, too, you know, not just patience. You got to be able to, you know, handle those invoices when they roll in also. You know, that's why I tell a lot of people that want to be in business, I say, hey, when those invoices roll in, that'll make or break you right there.
What are people buying?
What they buying now, they buying a lot of the fruits up out of there, a lot of fresh vegetables.
Fresh produce.
Yeah. They when they walk in, they was like, we never knew this was here. And like right now, when I leave here, I got to go put another order in now for the produce.
And when you get your produce, how do you do it? How did you figure that whole process out? That's one of the biggest jobs at a grocery store, even a major supermarket.
Mm-hmm. How do I figure out as far as?
Yeah, how did you figure out? Because it's kind of a logistics thing, right? I mean,
yeah, yes,
getting a variety of things.
Mm-hmm. See, what I do, I see what sells the most. And funny as it may sound, I sell more green tomatoes than I sell red tomatoes.
Why is that, do you think? Have you asked anybody?
No, I just sell them to them. I don't ask. They want to buy them, I let them buy them. But I sell more green than I sell red. And now I just got some corn in the other day, and it's gone.
So it's a it sounds like it's a seasonal cycle for you and your inventory.
Yes, sir, it is.
What's the most important thing that you want to improve right now? Something that could help ANI make the biggest impact that it can.
One thing that I can improve, we want to improve as far as ANI to make a change. I probably getting out more marketing, better marketing, whatever, letting more people know that ANI is here with the fresh produce, fresh meat, everything.
Jonathan, can you talk about what you do and how long you've been a farmer here?
Oh, I've been farming a long time. Me and my wife set up Brandywine Creek Farms in 2016. After my son basically told us about how his school had a food pantry. And
What did that mean? Like,
well, I mean,
kids taking home food because their parents don't have any?
Yeah. I mean, that's what he was telling us, which was a shocker for us, because if you leave my farm and drive to my son's school, all you do is pass farms. You don't pass neighborhoods. You don't pass businesses. It's just, I mean, even at his school, I mean, they have cattle on campus as teaching tools. So it's a school in the heart of an agricultural community, and there's a food pantry there. So me and my wife started looking at hunger, and not just to us. As farmers, hunger to us, somebody that was hungry was a person living under a bridge in Indianapolis, which, while it's only 27 miles from my farm, might as well have been 2,700 miles away, because we just didn't go to Indianapolis. So
So the role that you think farmers should play in this is, if the food's there, give it to the people who are there.
Well, yeah, I mean, that and, you know, wow, that's a loaded question. What should the farmers be doing? It's a hard, Indiana imports, like 98% of its food. I personally, as a farmer, I mean, Brandywine Creek Farms is a nonprofit and a for-profit that's kind of combined. My wholesale operation does very little inside the state of Indiana, because there's just no outlets for Indiana growers of scale here. I mean, I supply to Robert, I supply, to Cleo's. But as Robert doesn't want, 4,500 pounds of tomatoes at once. And that is difficult, because that's what we have. So where we've been blessed is we've had hospitals, like IU Health, and in the past Hancock Regional, Community Health, that have came in and subsidized our work so that we can just donate, produce to where it needs to go. We can work with an organization like Flanner House. They've already done all the work as far as identifying the problem. And that takes, now Brandywine Creek Farms doesn't have to act as a social worker and determine who needs fed. Flanner House has already done that. Edna Martin Christian Center has already done that. The Martin Luther King Center has already done that. And they're really, really good at it. They're better at it than the government officials who are pointing at this stuff. And, working with them, we can provide food, and it's just – boom, it goes in the community.
Sounds to me like your food access efforts are prioritizing. You're prioritizing your inventory to go toward who needs it locally.
Right, yeah. I mean, that's I've always said that the solution to hunger in the United States is and always has been the American farmer. The problem is every possible roadblock that can be put up has been put up in front of farmers in order to address that.
Let's talk about those obstacles. What do you see as the main obstacle that prevents more farmers from getting involved in food access projects the way that you have?
Well, they don't want to be involved in it. I mean, they just don't. I mean, it's the ideology that is pressed today, for the most part, through certain movements, is that, as farmers, we are destructive to the environment. I actually just got a email a couple of days ago from a lady who found out that we're not an organic farm. And she said that it would be better for the people to starve than to eat our toxic food.
Wow. Hmm.
That is an ideology that I couldn't comprehend. And when I do have people ask me that question, I always say, you know, people like me and Robert and other people that don't worry where our next food meal comes from, we have a lot of problems. Hungry people only have one.
Yeah.
And, you know, we try not to let ideology stand in the way of getting out there and helping the people who need the help. So
what are you growing?
So right now, and mind you, this is, as a farmer, I can tell you this is, 2019 has been the worst season I've ever seen farming. And I talk to older farmers and they say the same thing.
A lot of heavy rain in the spring. And
yeah. So,
I mean, I'm sure it goes beyond that.
I mean, we lost acres and acres of produce, you know, not just, I mean, acres. We typically plant 113 acres. We only planted 29 this year. That's all we could get into the ground. Just because it was the early rains were so bad. But currently I have watermelons, tomatoes, kale, collard greens, we're still planting, but we've just planted some turnips and radishes. So
getting into the winter root stuff.
Yep.
Yeah. So all fresh, and you say most of it is going out of state.
So in order for Brandywine Creek Farms to be able to donate the produce we do, we have to sell some.
Of course.
And
it's a business.
Yeah, it does not stay. It can't. I mean, there's no significant buyers of produce here locally. And, you know, as far as restaurants that buy local food, I think that's awesome that they do that. But as a scaled farmer, I can't pay someone, nor can I go out and go to individual chefs and say, hey, do you want to buy 20 pounds of tomatoes? I mean, I would love, I mean, chefs are welcome to come to our farm, and we've had that happen, but you know.
Robert, can you talk about what people are asking for when they come into the store? That you maybe don't have? Hey, could you get in this in the minute or so that we have left?
Wow. I pretty much have everything that they ask for.
Well, that's good. It's a good problem to have, I guess.
Right. Yes, sir. But one thing I noticed now, and I was going to get with Jonathan on this, they're asking for zucchini now.
Oh, yeah. So, well, yeah. It's that time of year, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If you can both stay with us for the next segment, that would be great. Robert Hurst and Jonathan Lawler will keep the conversation going, all right?
Thank you.
Up next, we'll bring in another voice to talk about urban agriculture and efforts on the West Side, and we would love to hear from you. Is it difficult to find healthy, affordable food where you live? What would make it better? Let us know on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. I'm Matt Pelser. Back in 2 minutes. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Before we get back to talking about food deserts, I want to tell you about our show last week on domestic violence. We talked to a group of experts and advocates about new research on domestic violence in Indiana, what support survivors can get in Marion County, and what people are doing to help. You can find a podcast of that episode and all past shows at WFYI.org/all in. You can also find us on Apple Podcasts and on Stitcher. Today, we're talking about food deserts and food access. Food deserts are areas where healthy, affordable food is difficult, sometimes impossible to find. As always, we're taking your questions and comments on social media. We especially want to hear from you. If you live in a food desert, find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. In the studio now, we welcome back Robert Hurst, owner of A&I Variety Meats and Produce on the Far East Side. Thank you for sticking with us, Robert.
Yes, sir.
Jonathan Lawler's back, of course. Jonathan's a farmer and owner of Brandywine Creek Farms. Thanks for staying with us.
Yep.
And we're joined now by Brandon Cosby. Brandon is executive director of Flanner House, a nonprofit community center in Indianapolis. Thanks for coming, Brandon.
Happy to be here.
Brandon, can you explain what Flanner House is and the ways it works on food access here?
Oh, my gosh. So what Flanner House is, we're actually the oldest social service agency in the state. We're 121 years old this year.
Really?
Money and land donated by Frank Flanner, who founded Flanner Buchanan Funeral Homes. He is the great-great uncle of Bruce Buchanan, who's the current CEO there. And actually, they hired Booker T. Washington to come to Indianapolis and help them design and create an organization that would specifically focus on moving African Americans from positions of crisis and instability to positions of self-reliance and self-determination. And that has manifested itself in education programs, early childhood education, workforce development strategies, and has a long history of being directly involved in agriculture in the 40s and 50s. John Moore was the director of the agriculture program at Flanner House, which also ran a food co-op, as well as we owned our own cannery. So people who were growing crops could bring them in after they harvested them and have them professionally canned, take home what they needed, and then leave behind what they didn't to be sold off in the co-op. And so I've been at Flanner House now for the last 3.5 years, and part of our work has really been kind of to reach back into our past to bring some of those historically significant initiatives and programs like agriculture back to the neighborhood and the community for the residents there.
And so what seems like this sort of new issue now, it's just sort of been kind of packaged for today. You've been working on it for decades, it sounds like.
Absolutely. It's in the DNA of our organization.
Sometimes certain parts of the city get more attention than others when food deserts come up. Can you talk about where you've focused your efforts and kind of give us a sense of how big the problem is?
Sure. So the northwest side, the near northwest side of Indianapolis, is actually one of the largest geographic areas where people are wrestling and challenged with issues in access to food security. The east side, probably with the closure of that Walmart grocery store, is probably now a larger geographic area than before. And so you're talking about a catchment area that is south to 10th Street, north to 38th Street, east to the interstate, and west to Kessler. And so no grocery store, no retail outlet. That most people were relegated to having to do their grocery shopping at the Family Dollar, which is right there on Martin Luther King, or finding ways to leave the neighborhood to be able to find access to food.
And that's something that people don't think about. I mean, people who have cars and can get around very easily, they just think, well, yeah, I just drive a little farther to the grocery store. It's not that simple for a lot of people.
Right. It's not that simple at all. And when you factor in, for example, as hot as it has been this summer, imagine having to take a bus to get to a grocery store, which may take 2 hours to be able to get there, and buying anything frozen. And then having to take the bus route, that 2-hour ride back. By the time you get home, it's spoiled or it's just – it's melted and been lost. So it's those kind of realities that people are up against on a regular basis that very frequently don't get talked about or considered.
Can you tell us about Cleo's Bodega and Cafe and how that got started?
Sure. It actually began in a community conversation. The Northwest Quality of Life is convened at Flanner House. And so we have all of those monthly community meetings. And residents had invited a developer to come and talk about the idea of putting a grocery store in the neighborhood. And one of the residents asked if the store that he was willing to put there would sell organic produce. And he looked at her and he told her that beggars can't be choosers. And I kind of intervened and not so politely threw him out and reminded him that the only begging that had actually happened was him begging to get on the agenda and the money that he was asking from the Northwest TIF to fund the project. And without a plan, a thought, or a clue in the world of how we were going to do it, I just turned and looked at the folks in the meeting that night and I said, forget it, we'll do it ourselves. And then promptly went home and had a panic attack. So that was the summer that we launched our plan to build an urban farm. And so we have a 1.9-acre farming operation on our campus. The first year didn't get off the ground at all with all the money that we were promised. And I got a phone call from my daughter, who runs a micro food pantry project called the Community Food Box Project. And she said, Dad, this crazy farmer called and said that he wants to put produce in my food pantry boxes, and I don't have time to talk to him. And so I called him back, and John Lawler answered the phone. And he and I began talking, and you know, he said, well, you're the guy that's trying to build a farm over there. Yeah. Well, how's it going? It's not. And he said, well, we can probably help with that. And I said, well, that'd be great. When can you come? He said, what are you doing tomorrow? And the very next day, John and his wife showed up with 3,000 pounds of produce that we sat in the back of his truck on the parking lot at Flanner House and gave away all of that food until it was gone. And then they proceeded to come back every week until there was nothing left that the crops were producing. And that was really what helped us be able to understand the true and the powerful impact of what it was we could do.
Jonathan, of course, is in the room. You remember this, of course?
I do. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's, I'm just wondering how that's where does the advocacy come from? I mean, obviously you care about the community and but why did you want to make yourself and your products available in this way?
Well, because I'm a farmer.
I mean, and you want people to you don't want it to go bad.
So, you know, without upsetting an apple cart or in my case, a tomato cart, you know, I have an issue with somebody that throws on a hemp hat and sandals that used to be a technology person, and all of a sudden they claim the title farmer.
Mm-hmm.
That's earned with blood, sweat, tears, diesel fuel. You know, I mean, it's
and it's oftentimes thankless.
Well, that and I mean we have the sixth most dangerous job on the planet as farmers. I mean, I know two people that have recently passed away. Well, they were killed in farm accidents.
Mm.
When I hear about our capital city suffering from food insecurity, Indiana is looked at globally as a leader in agriculture. Why are there hungry people here? It's not because there's a lack of farmers in Indiana, and it's not because there's a lack of, that we can't produce the food that people need. There's something else, and I decided to go around the system and go straight to the – I mean, Brandon's doing the work in the neighborhood. He knows the people that I'm trying to reach. Go and talk to someone from the government, and they're like, you know, you got to sign this paper and jump through five hoops and then still get nowhere. But Brandon had a direct line to where we were trying to reach, and then that's, you know – I went from there.
Caitlin from Twitter got a hold of us. She asks, with regards to urban farming, can you discuss the high heavy metal concentrations in the city soil and how people can learn what they should avoid planting in these areas?
Sure. Well, I mean, and that was one of the big worries and concerns that we had. And John came out and worked with us, and we took soil samples across our entire area and then took some samples in some adjacent land as well to be able to really see overall what we were looking at. Fortunately, we got feedback that our soil, in fact, wasn't contaminated. I mean, and that's one of the things that I always tell people is, A, don't plant in your soil if you haven't had it tested. But also, B, don't automatically assume that your soil is contaminated because you live in a city or an urban area, because that may not necessarily be so. What we actually ended up discovering was that where our farm sits used to be a neighborhood back in the 50s that was cleared. Well, when they knocked down all of those houses, rather than hauling everything away, they just pushed everything in the basements and they brought in fill dirt. Mm. What we discovered is that the fill dirt actually came from the bottoms of riverbeds. So we had this incredibly nutrient-rich soil that was just dumped right there and had been laying dormant for the last 35 years that just basically hadn't been used.
Yeah, let Caitlin know that the organic matter content there was almost 12%, which is
– wow.
I wish I had that. I mean, it just – it was really, really, really high. I mean, I'd never seen – I mean, you know, typically, you know, good soil is 7 to 8 and –
so let's put it to use.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Brandon, let me come back to you. What's the reception been like since Cleo's opened? Has it been easy to get the word out about it?
It has. I mean, it's been absolutely amazing. I mean, so much to the day to when we actually had our grand opening. It was a ribbon cutting, and it was really more of kind of like a public ceremony than us actually planning to be open for business that day. And very quickly, we found out that residents in the neighborhood were like, no, if y'all are cutting this ribbon, then we're buying things today. So we had to do this mad dash to the bank to get change to put in the cash drawers, because we really hadn't anticipated on selling anything the first day. But literally, folks were lined up hours before. We had residents folks from the neighborhood who volunteered their time that came in the days leading up to help stock the shelves. I mean, it has just been – it is – the response has been absolutely amazing and overwhelming. And to have both a grocery store operation on one side and a cafe where folks can actually sit down, come together, talk, meet, eat, has just been huge.
Has the business part of Cleo's Bodega been a challenge so far?
It hasn't. In the sense, the frustration that we have on the bodega side is that we're still waiting for our EBT approval. Mm. And we know that our sales will significantly go up once that approval comes through. But sales have been so incredibly prolific on the cafe side that it's actually carrying the grocery store side while we're still trying to get that worked out. We were also very fortunate enough to have support from philanthropy to really help us underwrite the cost of getting the doors open. And that's one of the challenges that I know that a lot of businesses have is that how much startup capital do you have? How much do you have to put in? And how soon does it have to start paying for itself before you can, you know, either get to a point of breaking even or the demands and the stresses of all of that debt owed? We opened our cafe and our bodega with zero debt.
Wow.
And so that was a real game changer for us and actually had enough money to be able to cover our operating expenses for our first 120 days. So we could tweak and mess with the model as we were working through it to make sure that we were actually operating in a way that was financially going to make it sustainable.
Robert Hurst, what about your business challenges? What do things look like at ANI?
Things are starting to look up now, you know, especially since the Walmart up the street just closed. Our sales went up at least like 35% so far. And, you know, just like Cleo's Bodega, the only difference with that, my wife and I, we did everything out of our pocket and stuff, and we're starting to see some of it come back now.
Yeah, I mean, back to you, Brandon, is there a certain way that grocery stores like Cleo's should be operated? Have you seen some projects fail because of something you thought that you could have avoided?
Well, I mean, I think the first part of it is, and it's like I said, Robert and his wife are very fortunate because a lot of people who are trying to get those stores open, they end up putting so much of their personal income in that if the business isn't successful within 45 to 60 days, they end up having to fold just because of the financial constraints of their reality. So for us, being able to take the time, raise the money. So, you know, our project was funded with a $400,000 community development block grant that we received from the city. Insight Development collaborated with us to bring another $375,000 to the project. CICF, and as well as a few other philanthropies, put money toward it so that literally we didn't have to deal with the stress and the anxiety that they dealt with to be able to focus inward. One of the other things that I tell people is that neighborhoods in urban areas, if you look at other cities, New York, Chicago, LA, bodegas are the lifeblood of those neighborhoods and communities. People don't go to big box grocery stores and power shop for 2 or 3 weeks. They go buy what they need for 2 or 3 days, knowing that in 2 or 3 days when they go back, what they need and what they want is going to be available to them. We have to shift the mindset about what grocery shopping looks like in the urban core. Big box stores, their profits are in pennies. Their margins are so incredibly tight that it becomes so incredibly cost prohibitive trying to maintain this 10, 20,000 square foot facility to heat it, to cool it, to staff it, to clean it. All of that, it eats you up. Versus if you think about scaling down so that you're talking about a very small, you know, footprint, small square footage with high density of product that's based on interaction in turn so that the more folks come in, the more they buy, the more we can get back on the shelves, the more that we can provide to them, that's a model that's significantly more sustainable because you're not being eaten alive by the facility's costs alone.
Jonathan.
Yeah, that – I mean, and just, you know, the research on the produce side for our retailers, Brandon and Robert have both, I think, found the perfect footprint for what the stores should look like, having it goes beyond just necessities. It's not a convenience store. I mean, it's better than that. They have better selections. And, you know, knowing what I sell to, you know, a produce broker, that 60 percent of that sometimes is going to go end up wasted mm-hmm. versus, you know, what Brandon and Robert are doing, you know, very little of that gets wasted. And, you know, food waste is a huge issue for the planet as a whole, you know. So this I think they've hit on something that works in Indianapolis, especially in the food desert areas, without having to sacrifice the quality of what's being in there.
But got about a minute left. What do you think of the group of programs that recently got funding from the City County Council? Anyone want to take that?
Well, I mean, I think that it's a mixed bag. You know, I mean, I think that the neighborhood food champions model is something that makes sense. You know, we were one of the city's projects that were funded. So I think that I wish that they had taken more time to look at how do you have conversations about replicating like a model like ours in neighborhoods and communities. I think that the idea of giving people Lyft rides and things like that is just not a sustainable model. What we're really trying to do is to repair the economic infrastructure of a community by using food as a vehicle to do that. And as long as you're continuing to send people out of the neighborhood, they're leaving, their dollars are leaving. There's no wealth being built back into that community.
I want to thank all three of you for giving us your time today. Brandon Cosby, Executive Director of Flanner House, thank you.
My pleasure.
Robert Hurst, owner of ANI Variety Meats and Produce. Thank you, Robert.
Yes, sir.
Jonathan Lawler, owner of Brandywine Creek Farms. Thanks again for sticking around in this segment.
Thank you.
Up next, we'll hear about new efforts from the city to address food access. And later, we'll hear my conversation with a food systems researcher. I'm Matt Pelser, back in 2 minutes. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Back now to our discussion on food deserts and food access. We're joined now by Brandon Hergett, Policy Director for the Indianapolis City County Council. Thanks for coming, Brandon.
Thank you.
And we're welcoming Malele Kennedy, Food Policy and Program Coordinator for the City of Indianapolis. Thanks, Malele.
Thank you.
Before we get into it, Malele, we really appreciate you coming in. I understand this is your first day on the job.
It is.
But this is you're no stranger to this topic, so it's not your first day dealing with this sort of thing.
No, not at all. I'm coming from Indy Parks as the food program manager, and I dealt mostly with the USDA programs around youth and food insecurity with children out of school time. So that's the summer food program and the CACFP programs.
So what's your role with the city going to be? Can you explain it? You're the food policy and program coordinator.
Yes. So my goal is to take what I've been working on throughout the community with our Indy Parks programs and really use that as a starting point to continue the work throughout the community in Indianapolis. So what I really want to do is learn about the community. What are the needs? What are the priorities that we need to be focusing on? What are the challenges that families have that they're facing around food insecurity and food access?
What did you learn as the food programs manager for Indy Parks, and how are you carrying that into this new job?
The one thing that I learned is that no matter what community you're in, there is definitely a need for better food access, and that there's challenges that are being faced every day. The other thing that I learned is that there are some great, great champions out there working to alleviate these issues within our community, and that they're doing a great job at addressing some of these disparities that we're seeing.
Brandon Hergett, you're the policy director for the City County Council. The council recently approved funding for a group of programs designed to address food deserts. Can you give us a quick rundown of what each one does?
Yeah, sure. Happy to. So you're referring to Proposal 258, and I think it's helpful to just provide a little bit of context here. We had a situation where the state of Indiana had miscalculated the amount of special distribution income tax that the county was receiving. And so we had a unique situation where $900,000 became available. And due to the work of Dr. Suttles, who I believe you're speaking with in the next segment, we had a number of programs that had been in the hopper, sort of shovel ready, if you will, ready to roll out. And the opportunity arose where we had funding to match those policy goals. So the funding included these are all meant to be pilot programs that we're kind of testing, receiving data that then we can use to inform additional policy in the future and work that our new food policy coordinator will be doing in the future. They included the LIFT pilot program, which Brandon Cosby alluded to earlier, the Food Champions program, which he also alluded to earlier, a new mobile food market, which is based on some ideas and models that we've seen that work in other communities like Milwaukee and Louisville. I know staff at the city has traveled to those cities and is working on that and building out what it would look like here. And then finally, the Food Compass app, which is something that is really exciting and has come after a number of years of work, including with Indy Civic Hack and that group.
There was a lot of debate at the City-County Council meeting mm-hmm. where Proposal 258 was passed, and most of the criticism towards the food programs came from people who thought that money wasn't being spent in the right places, which a common sentiment was that the investments were being ignoring important community efforts and helping large corporations. What mm-hmm. did you think of those arguments?
Yeah, I mean, look, I completely understand those arguments. And obviously, we are a body that is responsive to our constituents. And so we certainly heard that feedback throughout the process, not only the night of the vote, but once the proposal was put forward through the committee process and in the weeks that followed after that. So we took some of that feedback and made some changes to 258 along the way. There were some amendments adopted on the floor that evening that addressed some of those community concerns. To speak specifically to paying for programs and giving money specifically to corporations, again, these aren't pie in the sky ideas. These were conversations that had been ongoing in the community with the community for the past several years. And they were, as I mentioned earlier, they were shovel-ready projects that were ready to go and are pilots that we're going to test and see how they work. And if we need to make improvements, we're already working, as an example, on the LIFT pilot program. That initially started as a cohort of stores, including A&I Meats, on the Far East Side, where we were going to get residents to existing stores, brick and mortar stores. We have now expanded that map to include neighborhoods on the near west side as well, other areas that are in great need. And so, you know, these are continuing conversations that we're excited to have with our constituents on the council.
In the minute or so we have left, Malele, what is the Indy Food Council, and can you talk a bit about the strategic action plan that's being worked on?
The Indy Food Council is a group of citizens, organizations, all interested in these topics of food access, food insecurity. And so together, we look at all of the issues that are going on. And, you know, there's some things that we can address and other things that we can't. But the one thing that we can do is be a voice. And so the Strategic Planning Committee has worked to ensure that everyone in the community has a voice. We encourage membership. It is an open membership so that if there's something going on in your specific community, in your neighborhood that you want to be a part of, you can join us.
Malele Kennedy, Food Policy and Program Coordinator for Indianapolis, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us, and good luck with the job. It's your first day.
Thank you.
And Brandon Herget, Policy Director for the City-County Council, thank you for coming.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
We're going to end the show today with a recent talk that I had with Shelley Suttles. Shelley used to be the city's Food Policy and Program Coordinator, and now she's a food systems researcher at Indiana University. That conversation's coming up in about 5 seconds. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for having me, Matt.
To start out, can you explain the research work that you're doing at IU?
Yeah, so I am in the Sustainable Food System Science Working Group, and this is housed in the Ostrom Workshop at Indiana University and funded by the Office of the Vice Provost for Research, and it's what they call an emerging area of research. And so we're using Eleanor Ostrom's methods of social ecological systems and using that framework amongst a wide group of researchers, so historians, statisticians, geographers, ecologists, economists, to explore the bottlenecks in the food system and where there's opportunity for sustainability and resiliency for diverse communities.
You hear food deserts and this problem of food insecurity and things like that being defined in many, many different ways. This seems like a comprehensive, all perspectives on deck sort of approach to it.
Yes, very much so.
You used to work for the city as its food policy and program coordinator. What is the partnership like now between IU's Sustainable Food Sciences Institute and the city?
So right now, the partnership is really kind of research support. So one thing that I had trouble, even though my background is in research, I have my PhD in agricultural economics. There is such overwhelming activity in the city around food access and food security. When we think about dividing the position between programs and policy, there really wasn't enough hours in the day to dive deep on research. So this is an opportunity for me to go back and do that. And so I understand a lot of the nuances and kind of bottlenecks in food access and food security in Marion County. So this is an opportunity for the city to partner with the Sustainable Food System Science Working Group and to really answer these questions in a very transdisciplinary, community-engaged way. There's a lot of confusion and conflation of food access and food security amongst residents. So if community, you know, is really passionate about one project, they really don't have an opportunity to dive deep on what are the root causes and the meaning of each problem. They create a solution for a different problem. So typically in our work, we would define food access as whether or not a household is a half mile or a mile from a retail grocery store. And this is very geographic in nature, and it really only depends on if that neighborhood is identified as a low-income neighborhood and has limited food access. And this is purely a retail grocery issue. On the other end, we look at food insecurity. And so this is whether or not a household has the financial means to be able to afford the food that they need for their family. And so this is, you know, the case I explain most simply to people as if Kroger was on, you know, a grocery store was on the end of your block. But at the end of the month, you've just run out of money and can't get the groceries that you need. So they are two very different and distinct issues. Some households may have overlapping struggles with both food issues. But at the end of the day, people have to be mindful of which solution they're looking to tackle so that they're not diagnosing a problem, coming up with a remedy for the actual wrong illness.
What then do you think that the city's role should be in addressing food access issues?
So I would say kind of having the experience of working for the mayor's office, I would say, you know, Mayor Hogsett at the time was very passionate about encouraging us as his employees to be supportive of community projects. And so that really drove my work in the city. And I would very much agree with him that the city's role is in supporting community organizations, residents, local businesses, and their projects and helping get those off the ground and support them in expansion and growth.
Do you think that care should be taken, though, before things are executed? Because there are a lot of quote-unquote solutions to this problem, and some of them are well-meaning but don't end up having the effectiveness that that they were sort of dreamt to at the outset.
Yeah, so I would say definitely having a background in agricultural economics helped me kind of dispel many of these myths in the community. So, you know, there's a myth in the, I would say globally, that there's food shortage. We actually know there's excess production of food globally. It's a matter of logistics. So the food isn't able to get exactly where it needs to be. And typically this is a problem with food access. So these neighborhoods struggle with limited food access because there's no retail outlet in their neighborhood. So it's important to know that urban farms, community gardens are great economic and community development tools. But at the end of the day, when we think about the conventional food system, there is actually enough food that is already grown. So I tell people to be very cautious of, you know, people coming from outside in the of the county with these silver bullet solutions to saying, oh, you know, I can do this for you. I'm going to I'm a big farmer here. I'm going to come do this in Marion County. There are 250 urban farms and gardens in Marion County people can support, people can volunteer at, people can patronize at the farmers market. So we have a lot going on here in Marion County. We don't necessarily need to look outside for this solution in terms of solving our problem with the public health crisis around healthy eating and just supporting urban farmers and community gardens and trying to do what they're doing to promote healthy eating.
What's an example of a big misconception you think people have about food deserts in Indianapolis specifically?
I would say a lot of people aren't really familiar with the process of maybe using public transportation to get groceries. So oftentimes we hear people say, well, people can just get on the bus or people can just use the bicycle to go to the grocery store. Maybe you can carry 1 to 2 bags of groceries home, but if you think away, most Americans shop, so most Americans, we know this from USDA research, most Americans, regardless of income, shop at supermarkets and supercenters. So they enjoy going to Kroger. They enjoy going to Walmart. They enjoy being able to buy diapers when they buy fresh fruit and vegetable. So they're really looking for kind of a larger full-service opportunity, and solutions need to be very attuned to helping people with a considerable amount of groceries after they're done shopping.
Yeah, there are a lot of factors at play here. There are factors that people don't think about. You know, if you own a car and you are, even if you're 10 miles from the nearest grocery store with fresh produce, you're still driving a car there. That's easy. If you don't own a car, you have to carry it. You have to take public transportation. All of these factors go into defining these areas. And some have criticized city leaders for thinking too short term. Small scale or temporary efforts to address food deserts won't make enough of a difference. How should people think about solving this long term and on the scale that's necessary?
Yeah, so I would say, you know, again, kind of there's a lot of myths and misconceptions about food access and food security out there. One very important conversation that needs to be had is that this cannot be a short-term or a long-term conversation. It has to be short-term and long-term. There are people with immediate needs right now in the short-term, and it would be, it'd do them a great disservice to ignore those short-term needs. But we also do need to think about a long-term plan. But at the same time, you know, a lot of people don't, haven't really been plugged in what's happening at the national level. So actually, at the start of this year, USDA's Food and Nutrition Service pilot is starting to pilot using SNAP or EBT benefits online. And so this is with Amazon and other national partners. So there is great conversation in the national food system community right now about Amazon and other online retailers really disrupting food retail, so grocery stores, and knowing that the U.S. Postal Service delivers to every single address in the United States, that the future of grocery will most likely be food delivery.
Well, in food delivery, there are a lot of providers for food delivery and not just the Postal Service. Do you see that as a potential solution, or is the expense too high for the people we're talking about serving?
Yeah, so there is conversation amongst, you know, people who live in inner city communities that feel maybe UPS or FedEx wouldn't feel comfortable delivering to their location, or the delivery cost is too high and you wouldn't be able to use your EBT benefits on the delivery cost. All of this is being worked out in this pilot scenario. But, you know, I tell people to fear not, because the Postal Service is there and does deliver to every location. So in certain cases, for households that can afford a high delivery cost, they may go through Amazon or FedEx. But, you know, the United States Postal Service is always looking for partners to keep their business alive and growing. And so I think that most likely will be that opportunity for all households in America to benefit from grocery delivery.
Shelley Settles, food systems researcher at Indiana University, former food policy and program coordinator for Indianapolis. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Today's show was produced by Drew Dodlin. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it on Stitcher or Apple Podcasts, as well as WFYI.org/allin.
Join us next time as we mark the 26th running of the NASCAR race formerly known as the Brickyard 400, the Big Machine Vodka 400 at the Brickyard, which happens Sunday, and we'll look at the history of NASCAR at IMS. We'll also talk to Xfinity Series driver and Mitchell, Indiana native Chase Briscoe, and fingers crossed, Monster Energy Cup Series driver Ryan Newman. He's a busy guy, but we're hoping we can chat with him about growing up racing in Indiana and how he made it to the big time. We'll be back Thursday at 1 for that conversation. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. This is All In.